Okay, here, let's start the next of the time periods, which is really the Tkufas HaGoinim, the time period of the Goinim, in mostly Babylonia, Bavel. But that's not to say that nothing was going on in Israel. Israel, there was a lot going on as well. There was a growth of not the Torah center, because the Torah center clearly had moved to Babylonia already towards the end of the beginning of the 5th century, Abaye Barava, end of the 4th century, was already the major center was Bavel. But Eretz Yisrael also had its flourishing periods in Paitanim, Rebbe Eliezer HaKalir, many say, was in the Goenic period in Eretz Yisrael. The whole Arab conquest, which affected obviously Babylonia, but also affected Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim. We'll see exactly what it means, the Arab conquest in Yerushalayim, what it meant for the Jews living over there, Ben Asher, the Seferim, who lived in the Goenic period, all that happened in Bavel, as in Eretz Yisrael as well, at the same time. So when we speak about the Goenic period, yeah, we focus on Bavel, Babylonia, but at the same time, there is a whole culture and a whole existence in Eretz Yisrael as well. So we'll speak about that as well. And by the way, the rest of the world, Spain, and the rest of the, will learn that after the Arab conquest, in the year 620, it started 630, in the 7th century, the Arab conquest, within 2-3 generations, they controlled basically from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, and that made that all into one land, the Arab lands, with the result that the Jews spread out throughout all these lands were connected. And that's really the beginning of the Sephardic period, right? The Sephardic period, the Rishonim in Spain and Northern Africa, that whole Arab under Muslim control really had its roots in, and it was a continuation of the Jews in Babel as well, the Goenic period. So the Goenic period is a very pivotal time. You know, the time of the Tanoim, we understand, obviously, the Mishnah, the Beis HaMikdash, the time of the Ma'amaroim, we have a lot of information as well about it. That's obviously the time of the Gemara. The time of the Goinim, we don't have that much as we do the Gemara, but it's a very important pivot from the time of the Amoraim to the time of the Rishonim, which Rishonim we almost look almost like modern day, because the Acharonim, clearly that's the time that we're in now. The Rishonim was just a period beforehand, but the Goenic period is like, you know, it's still from the time of the Gemara. But it's not really like that. It was really a bridge between the Gemara, the Amoraic period, the Gemara, which we have written, and the Western world, which is Western Europe, Rishonim, and so on and so forth. So I think it's a very, very crucial time period. A lot of things happen in that time period, which lay the foundations for the continued evolvement of the Torah and Torah centers and Yiddishkeit as we know it today. That pivotal time period was in the Goenic period. So when does this Goenic period start? We know that the Gemara was finished towards the year 500 by Ravina, Ravashi, Babel, we know that. We know there was an in-between period, the period of the Rabbanon Sevaroi. The Rabbanon Sevaroi, which we always used to think, they really didn't do much. It was just like, we don't know much about them. But the more we learned about it, at the end of last semester, we learned about the Rabbanon Sevaroi, we saw they did quite a lot. The Seder Tanoim V'Amoraim, in number one on the sheet, just mentioned briefly, V'Achareim Rabbanon Sevaroi, Shebizchusam Nimtichu Shemayim V'Nir Ka'oretz, you know, the great Rabbanon Sevaroi. Sevaroi means explain. They explain the Gemara. Ad Rav Gide v'Rav Simuna Shayesoif Sevaroi. Rav Gide was the end of the Rabbanon Sevaroi. Says the Seder Tanoim V'Amoraim, Loi Haysifu V'Loi Fligu Midaitan Klum. They didn't add anything of their own. Elo Tiknu Prokim Shebechol Tenuye Kesidron. But they organized the various chapters. They organized the various places in the Gemara. So what we understood when we learned this last time in depth is that they explained the Gemara, they edited the Gemara, the final edition of the Gemara, they edited, they put in various simonim in the Gemara. When the Gemara says, simon, so and so, what's going to come, they put that in. They did some explanations in the Gemara. They also were the ones who wrote the Masechtes Ktanos, They also the ones, right, the Masechtas Ketanas, which are Masechtas on Kriyas HaTorah and Sefer Torah and Kala, and all these small Masechtas, which is part of our liturgy, and we don't really quite know when it was accepted by everybody, because it's accepted almost like a Gemara is accepted. Nobody argues on it, and yet it's not from the time of Rishonim. If it's time of Rishonim, you'd have other Rishonim arguing on it. The fact that this was accepted by everybody must have been from an earlier period. And we found that it actually came from the Rabbanon Sevaroi. Again, that was missing. They filled in a lot of the blanks which were in the Gemara. That's what they did. They also did other things, part of Nuschoi Satzvila, various takonas on the daily liturgy and the daily rituals. You know, how many Sefer Torah you take out, things like that. They did quite a lot in the time, in the 100, 150 years that the Rabbanon Sevaroi were around. But this is important. Towards the end of the Rabbanon Sevaroi, then the way Rav Shrira Goin writes it, Rav Shrira Goin was from the last Goinim, and he writes the history in the Igeres of Shrira Goin, number 2, V'have shnei shmad v'tzoreis v'soif malchus parsoim. Towards the end of the Persian Sasanian dynasty, that's right before the Arab conquest. The Arab conquest is in the year, what, 620, 630, whenever it was. So towards the end, the last 50, 60, 100 years, it was Shnei Shmad, B'tzoreis. It was a difficult time, a time of persecution in Babylonia. B'soif Malchus Pasoin, at the end of the Persian dynasty. V'loi havi yecholin le'mikva pirka, and they could not set aside their regular schedule of learning of the Masifta of the yeshivas. Vasuve Masifta, and they couldn't sit down in the Masifta in the great academies of Sura and Pumbedisa. Umidbar minagoinim, or they umidaber minagoinim, and they couldn't. I guess I know what that means, but couldn't do something. Ad Bosar Kamashnin, until a couple of years later, the Osar Rabbonon Dilona mi Pumbedisa, until our rabbis moved from Pumbedisa, which was in the north, Lisvivais Naldo Limidinosa de Proiz Shvar, until they moved to Prirus Shvar. In other words, Prirus Shvar was a different section in Babel. We had Pumbedisa on the north, we had Sura in the south, and Prirus Shvar, which was near Nahardo, which was more the center. Now, for some reason, they couldn't have the regular academies go on in Pumbedisa north and Sura in the south, which had been going on the academy for hundreds of years, and therefore they made an escape to Pirushvar, because that's where the persecutions were less. What exactly took place, we don't really know, but that was the time period of the Rabbanon Sevaroi when there was Shmad and there was Tzoreis. It's not really clear. They moved out of Pumbedisa.
Because it's in the north.
It was in the north, and therefore...
That's the biggest... That was where the influx was coming from.
I know, but it wasn't the Arab conquest. They came from Arabian land.
Correct.
Too early.
Too early, and so, behind.
So
if anything Turkey's above them...
I know, but what was going on? So there's a theory going on. I mean, I would think that the reason... We know there was unrest. We know there was unrest, but it wasn't just unrest. It's Shnei Shmad with Saras. That means there was religious persecution. The way of lifestyle, their regular lifestyle, was hampered. And therefore they said, okay, let's go somewhere else. Let's go somewhere where we're more protected. Maybe they had different medinas, different provinces. But for some reason, Purushvar was more protected. What I think was, by the way, and I think why I'm saying this, we've done this in the past, but I'm going to go through it again because I think we'll soon see that right after this, when the Goinim took over, when it became officially, or didn't come officially, when it evolved into the time of the Goinim, so besides all the things the Goinim did, they also enacted takonas, new enactments. Against the Gemara, they enacted certain takonas. And the very first takana they enacted was, we'll see at the end of this year, was a takana about forcing the husband to give a get. And why was that such an important takana to do at that time period? And we're going to soon see what the takana was. And I think the reason is, because that was the reason to the Shmad and the Tzaris. What am I referring to? So if you look in number 3 in the sheet, so it talks about Marzutra, Exilarch. He was...
Is this the Marzutra?
No. It's a different Marzutra. Well, many of them are called Marzutra. Marzutra in the Gemara is not this one. Not the, no, clearly not. Marzutra Gemara is much earlier. But Marzutra the second, see, Marzutra the second, exilarch, born about 496, died about 420, young man, 26, 24 years old. Ruled from 512 to 520. What happened? Marzutra took up arms against the Persians and organized an uprising to oppose the introduction of communism, although the king himself was in favor thereof. As the head of a company of 400 Jewish warriors, Marzutra advanced against the opposing Persian forces. Pillar of fire preceded his army. For the state of Marzutra found an independent Jewish state with Machoz as his residence. Machoz is in the center. He ruled as an independent king, imposed heavy tax on all non-Jews. In spite of the available government, however, immorality spread among his people, whereupon the pillar of fire disappeared. In a subsequent battle between Marzutra and the Persians, the former was defeated, and both he and his grandfather Hanina, was one of the Rabbanus of Aroi, were taken prisoners and decapitated, the bodies being suspended from crosses on the bridge at Machozu. That's why he only lived 26 years. He was killed because he led a revolution. He led a revolution against the introduction of communism. What is this communism that was being introduced? So what they refer to is in the end of the Persian reign, so they had an extreme form of Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism was the religion in Persia, and they had an extreme form. There was a fellow called, we did this in the past, Mazdak the Elder. And he had a philosophy that everything goes. Everything belongs to everybody, and everything goes. With the result that there was no personal property, and even the wives, each other's wives, were not personal anymore. It was like free love, communism, everything goes. And that was his religion. It was an extreme form of Zoroastrianism. Look at number 4a. A Zoroastrian philosopher known as Mazdak the Elder, who taught a combination of altruism and hedonism, directed his followers to enjoy the pleasures of life, satisfy the appetite in the highest degree, eating and drinking, spirit of equality, and of good deeds, same sending blood, you know, communism in its purest form. And then he says, this doctrine was further developed by a much better known Mazdak the Younger. At later stages, the conservative Zoroastrian position accused Mazdak of heresy, abhorrent practices, such as sharing of women, called for social revolution, even referred to as early communism. Mazdak's teaching acquired many followers, to the point where King Kavad, ruling from 5481 to 531, converted to Mazdakism. So clearly, that's what was going on in the time of Marzutra. And Marzutra saw this, and this obviously goes against everything that Judaism stands for. Right? You can't have this, everything is being shared by everybody, this Arias going on over here. He couldn't do this. So Marzutra says, in that time period, he says the king was against it. It says, although the king himself was in favor thereof, the king himself was part of this because he converted to this type of religion. Marzutra says, this is infringing too much on our way of life, and therefore he opposed it, and he tried to organize a rebellion. It could be that the fallout of this, when they killed Marzutra, and they hung him from the crosses on the bridge at Machuza, obviously that caused even more tsaris and shmad to the Jews in that area, and therefore that's probably the tsaris and shmad that Rav Shrira Goyen refers to. Last time I showed the number 4, I'm not going to go through this again, but basically it talks about Rav Bruke Chuzo, who Rashi says he went on the street and he looked, saw Eliyahu Navi, and he asked him who goes to Elam Haba, and he says this person over here, and who's that person? He's a Zandukna. What's a Zandukna? Zandukna is a prison guard, and what happens is he separates between the men and the women. In other words, there shouldn't be any stuff going on between the men and the women, Jewish women and foreign men. And according to Darius Hashanian, the Zandukna is like Mazdakism, which is this form. He disguised himself as one of these followers, and they gave him in charge of the prison, and he prevented all this going on, that it shouldn't happen to the Jewish women, and therefore he's the Ben Olam Haba. So according to the Deres Hashanim, there's actually a source to this Mazdakism, this new type of, you know, Hefkeris, this new type of everything goes in the Gemara, and therefore that's really what the Shmad perhaps was during the time in Bavel. Because there was no real other Shmad. We don't find any of the kings. Yes, some were a little bit better, some a little bit worse, but the Jews more or less had their own autonomy and they ran their own affairs. So to say Shmad and Tzaris, it must be from this you know, this new type of religion that was coming across the land, and people were being sucked into it. And obviously that's maybe why Mazutra went against it, he revolted against it, and hence there was a crackdown, and maybe that caused more tsaros. The bottom line is, they went to Piruz Shvar. Now, they were in Piruz Shvar for like 50 years, last 40, 50 years of the Rabbanus of Roy. In the year 589, there was a new king, and he was very benevolent, and they decided, we're going to reopen the academy in Pumpedisa. When they reopened the academy of Pumpedisa, it was a person by the name of Rav Hanan Mishkaya. That officially is called the beginning of the Gaonic period. When they reopened, they left from Piruz Shvar, where the Rabbanus of Roy were, where they escaped to, and they decided, okay, things are better now, let's move back to Pumpedisa in the year 589, let's move back to Sura in the south in the year 609, 20 years later, the opening of the two yeshivas again, it marks a new time period, a transition period, that's officially called the start of the Gaonic period in the year 589. The Gaonic period lasted from 589 until the year 1038. The last Gaonim was Rav Hai Gaon. Rav Hai Gaon was the son of Rav Shira Gaon. Igeres Rav Shira Gaon, his son was Rav Hai Gaon. 1038, 450 years, the entire Gaonic period. When did it start? Look at number 2a, Rav Shira Gaon writes, the Ilan Gaonim, the Have, the Dinosa Dilona, Bepumpedisa, and these Gaonim that came back in our country, where? Pumpedisa, because of Shir Gaon was in Pumpedisa. Bosor Ilan Malin Besoy Malchus Parsaim, after what happened at towards the end of the Persian Sasanic period in the year 589, towards that end, when they left Piruz Shvar and they came back to Pumpedisa, Bishnas Tov Tov Kuf Shana, in the year 589, Molach Mar Hanan Meishkaya. That's when Mar is always a sign of a Gaon. A Gaon is written with Mar, Mister. Why? I don't know. Not Rebbe, but Mar. Mar Hanan Meishkaya, the first of the Gaonim. Ubasrei, and after him, Molach Mar Rav Meri Zekeinenu. He was a descendant of Rav Mori, our ancestor. Brei de Mar Avdim Isargoi. Beis Medrashoi Nageh Bipurushva Adayem Nikro Be'Rav Meri. Rav Shira says that Rav Mori, who was the second, because Rav Hanan Mishkaya was only a Goyin in Pumpedisa for 2 years. He was already a very old man when they appointed him Goyin in Pumpedisa. So he led them back to Pumpedisa. He died 2 years later. Right afterwards, Rav Mori became the second Goyin in Pumpedisa. But Rav Mori was originally from Piruz Shvar, because he only came 2 years earlier. So that's Rav Shir Gaon writes, that Rav Mori, my ancestor, who is from originally from Piruz Shvar, and he still has his base medrash there. But he moved to Pumpedisa to take over the Gaonis, to be the leader of the academy, the second one. Uveyomov Molach Besura, and in his time, 15 years later, 609, the one who was in charge, Molach, he ruled in Sura, Rav Mar Bar Rav Huna, Bishnas Tov Tov Kuch, Chokhov, which is 609, and V'achre Rav Meri Soga, Molach Ben Ado, Mar Rav Chinene Ben Megiora, which is that, by the way, even though we had Pumpedisa and Sura, and Rav Hanan Meshkaya was in Pumpedisa, and Rav Mar Bar Rav Huna in 609 was in Sura, but they didn't just close up shop in Piruz Shvar. Why shouldn't they have a yeshiva there also? It wasn't from the two academies, but they still had a Beis Medrash there. So Rav Chinene Ben Begiura took over in Narda, which is Piruz Shvar, in the area of Piruz Shvar, Narda, Uveyamov Yotza Mahmad. Who's Mahmad? Muhammad, exactly. La'ilam. That's when Muhammad started coming to the world, and Rav Shira Gaon goes up further. Very, very important, because the Arab conquest changed a lot. It changed a lot, not just geopolitically, it changed a lot for religious, tshuvas, takanas, changed a lot. So So Rav Sudir Goyen makes a point of mentioning that that Muhammad took over in the year 620, and that's when he came to the world, so to speak, and that's when things started to change. So Rav Sudir Goyen gives us the opening to the time of the Goyenim, 589, they left Peshawar, they came to Pumbedisa, 609 they went down to Sura, and they had two academies. Now, they had two academies for 450 years. You know how many Goyenim did they have in each? They had about 50 each. 50 in Pumbedisa and 50 in Sura. It's a lot. They had almost every 8-9 years, they had another Goyen. Why was that? Because there was a whole, I'm going to read about it, they had a whole hierarchy how somebody was appointed as the head, as the Goyen. It was a lifetime position. But they only appointed the Goyen, the head, the Reish Masifta, many times only after you went through the whole system. There was a system of sitting in rows, where you sat in a row. Fascinating. We're going to read all about it. But the result, that the most of the Goyenim that were appointed were much older. They're ready towards the end of their life. And therefore, many of their Goyenim, their reign was not more than a couple of years. Yeah, you had a few that were for many years, but many of them were there only for a couple of years. Because you didn't just become a Goyen, didn't just take anybody, it was a whole hierarchy, it was a whole system. So therefore, they had 50 Goyenim in Sura and Pumbedisa in 450 years. That now, which one was greater, Sura or Pumbedisa? It really varied and it depended on the time. Clearly, in the beginning, Pumbedisa was the place. Right, that's where everything happened. That's where, from time of Abai, Rava, Rava, Rav Yosef, was all Pumbedisa. But over time, it changed and it became back to Sura. Then it went back to Pumbedisa. And there's, you know, the conflicting opinions about that.
It ended in Pumbedisa.
It ended in Pumbedisa. Rav Shir Goyen and Rav Hai Goyen were in Pumbedisa, correct? In the middle period, maybe Sura. We're going to read up. We're going to learn about the inner workings and the inner fights and the Reish Galusa. That's a whole separate thing. Maybe in 2 weeks from now we'll discuss the head of the Exilarch, how he got involved, and when he put his two cents in, and who won and who lost, and different Goyenim that, you know, didn't quite make it, but really became much more famous in other places. There was a lot of inner politics as well. You know, so a lot of Goyenim. Most of the Goyenim, we don't have much about them, though quite a number left behind tshuvas.
We have names.
We have names. We have names of almost all the Goyenim. Correct. We have names of almost all the Goyenim. But if I tell you, you know, Rav Yudoy Goyen, everybody knows about. But Rav Chanan or Rav Mar or Rav Netunoy, like, what do they do? We don't know much about it. There are tshuvas from certain Goyenim, and we're going to read, and it gives us insights of what took place. But the Goyenic period was really a lot of things that took place in the time period, and we're going to learn 450 years much faster than we did any other 450 year period. Which means, you know, 450 years, that means from Bayis Sheni, Chuban Bayis Sheni, the entire 3-4 years that we spent during Jewish history, Bayis Sheni, from Yavne, that was how many years ago we do Yavne? 4 years ago? So, but this won't be like that because there's much less material. But I think overlooking, and I'm going to go a little bit chronologically, but rather I think looking from a general perspective, knowing things, what took place in that time period, will give us an understanding what it meant for the future. So the first thing which I want to discuss, before we get to the Reish Galus and everything else, what was the Masifta? What was the Gaonic period? What did they do? What did it look like? Right? What were these things? What did it look like, this academy? Was it much different than the time of Amoraim? Probably not. Do we know what the academy looked like in the time of Amoraim? In the time of the Goyenim? There's no Gemara describing what the... Yeah, the Gemara says...
You get the rose.
You get a little bit over here. Oh, yeah, exactly. Pirka, Kala, what do these things mean? There's no real first-hand description. The Gemara throws it in. When the Gemara says something, in this day, that's when this... But there was a fellow, Reb Nosson HaBavli, who lived in the 10th century, he actually wrote an account of what the academy looked like in the 900s. Now, suffice it to say, probably what it looked like in 950 is probably the same way it looked in the year 650. There's no reason to believe that it was any different. They were, you know, quite conservative, I suppose, in the outlook. They weren't that progressive. There wasn't much to change. It wasn't the same Bavel. So when he tells us this is, and these are his words, what took place, I think we can get a general picture of what life was like, at least in the academy, in the Masifta, in the time of the Gaonic period. So look what he says over here. Clearly, there was the yeshiva, and that people learning, right, that we know. And they had the Rosh Masifta, the head of the Gaon. And by the way, they had the Gaon in Sura, in the south, and the Gaon in Pumpadisa, in the north. For some reason, the Gaon of Sura was called Rosh Yeshiva, the Gaon of Pumpadisa was called Rosh Yeshivas Gaon Yaakov. That was his official title. The Gaon in Sura was called Rosh Yeshiva Shel Gola, from the, you know, entire Golas. I don't know why it's like that, but he was called Rosh Yeshivas Gaon Yaakov, and he's called Rosh Yeshiva Shel Gola.
Because Yaakov gave a lot of money.
I don't know the reason why, but they had two different names. Now, clearly they had learning, and what did they learn? They learned the Gemara, and they went through it, and they brought all the halachic implications. Probably not much different than a time down the Rhine, just they had a book to go with, and they followed that book. Remember we showed that in the beginning of the Rabbanus of Roy, even though they wrote down the Gemara, they didn't really learn from the written book. Their job in the Rabbanus of Roy was to try and promote that this is the book that we're learning, the Gemara. In the time of the Gaonim, I suppose it was already, everybody was learning the Gemara. It was already written down, and that's what they all did. Not only that, but when we find historically that one of the Gaonim came to Spain, I forgot which one it was, so the first thing that he did is painstakingly write over the entire Talmud Bavli. Because that was the book that everybody was learning. Right? We're talking now 200 years after the Gemara was written. 200 years after the Amoraim. So this was the book that everybody was learning. So clearly, they were learning Gemara in the Masifta, in the academy, just like we are learning the Gemara in our yeshivas. Not only that, but at the end, this is very important. So they learned it for the entire year. But the end of a time period of a Zman, the year was divided into two Zmanim, into 2 6-month periods. And the last month of this learning cycle was called the Yarche Kala. The month of the Kala. What's Kala? Kala in Aramaic means rose. There's a lot of rose in Beis Medrash. That was the time when everybody came to the Masifta, and everybody, what it really was, is that everybody had learned. What, in other words, they had it twice a year. They had it in the month of Adar, and they had it in the month of Elul. Why did they have it in those 2 months? I thought it's because before Pesach and before Yom Tovim. But it's not. I think agriculturally, Adar and Elul, yeah, dead month, exactly. Pesach is ready, springtime, that's when you got to start harvesting. Elul, nothing. You've harvested in summer, it's drying out, you're not doing anything yet. Adar and Elul, that was the free time that they had. And therefore, everybody would gather in the Masifta, Adar and Elul. Now, they would learn, they would announce, in Adar, for example, in Adar, they would announce, the Rosh Masifta would announce, for the next 5 months, we're learning this and this Masechta. Those Talmidim that were in the yeshiva, in the academy, learned it in the academy. Everybody else went home, and they probably had chaburis wherever they were. They would learn the same Masechta as the academy is learning. And then 5 months later, in Elul, they would come, and they would have how they would sit in rows. We're going to see exactly how they would sit. And that's when they gave all the discussions and the shiurim, and everything was discussed, and what did you learn? And the Reish Masifta, the head, the goyim, who would discuss with everybody, and questions would come up, and that was when the shiurim were given on this topic. In other words, people went home to their work, and they would learn in their various batei midrashes, in their various places, what the main academy, either Sura or Pumpadisa, would be learning. Were they both learning the same? I don't know. If Sura producer always did the same thing, I don't know. But clearly, anybody in the area of Sura would go to their Beis Medrash, come the month of the Kala, Yarche Kala, they would come all prepared, what they've been learning the last 5 months, and then they would discuss it with everybody, and they would hear Shurim about it, given by the Goyim, and that was a twice a year occurrence.
Not
look,
today.
What?
Not that different today.
That's the idea of the Yarche Kala.
What are they doing? He said Mira started this.
Correct. That's the value. But they don't gather together at the end of the Zman, 4 weeks, everybody, in order to hear all the Torah from all the Gedolei Hador and everything.
That would be better.
Yeah, of course that would be better. Look at number five. And this is his Edus of Reb Nosson HaBavli of the 10th century. Uboin b'kola mekoymus, they come from all the places, b'chodesh kala, the month of the kala, which is the kala means rose, shu chodesh elul, b'mei akayitz, v'adar b'mei achoyev. What? Right. Adar at the end of the winter, and elul at the end of the summer. B'chol echad v'echad min ha-talmidim, and everybody the talmidim, b'mkoymoy goyres u'ma'ayin, in his own place, wherever he's working, he learns, kol oisam hechadoshim, the last 5 months, from Adar till Elul, they learned the new Masechta. A Masechta sha'omulehem Rosh Yeshiva b'tzeisa me'imoy uva'adar omulehem Masechta's plainness nigreiz be'elul. So in Adar he would say, the next 5 months, we're going to learn this Masechta. Be prepared, learn the Masechta. U'kemoykein be'elul, and so to an Elul, omulehem Masechta plainness nigreiz be'adar. In Elul they would say, in Adar this is what we're going to learn. Uboin kulon v'yosh milifnei Rosh Hashivas va'adu ve'elol v'Rosh Hashiva oimed aleim al gesosom uboidikosom. And the Rosh Hashiva speaks to them in learning, checks them out, sees where they're holding. Now, v'zeh seder yeshivasom. This is how they would sit. Rosh Hashiva oimed v'rosh. The Rosh Hashiva would stand in the front. Ulefanav in front of him, asoro anoshim. 10 people. In other words, the first row, v'yinikris doro kama. The first row, upneim upnei Rosh Hashiva. Their faces are facing Rosh Hashiva. Vasore sheyeshim lefanov mehen roshei kalois v'gimel chaverim. 7 of them, zayin mem. 7 of them are called roshei kala, and 3 of them are just regular chaverim. What is roshei kala? Have you heard of that expression before? Ever heard of roshei kala before? Usher, you ever heard of roshei kala? You say it every single week. How can you not hear it? Turn to the next page. Number 6. Yukum purkan min shemaya. Chino v'chizdo v'rachamei. V'chaye arichei. Give life. U'mezoyne revichei v'siyate l'shemaya. U'vayus guf and good health. U'nohir amalia. Zaro chai v'kayoma. Give life children. Zar d'ilivsoik. Children that are not going to die. V'dilo yivtum p'izgom v'raise. They're not going to stop learning Torah. Luhu. Limbaronon v'rabonon. To the rabbis, Chaburasa, Kadishasa, the holy Chabura, Diva Arad Yisrael, that are living in Israel, V'diba Ravel, living in Babel, L'Reishe Chale, to the Roshe Kala. What are Reishe Kale? U'L'Reishe Galvasa, what is that? U'L'Reishe Misivasa, what is that? U'L'Dayana Zavava, what is that? What are these things? He said every single week. So Reishe Kale are the 7 people sitting in the first row. Why are they called Reishe Kale? Because how many rows are there in front of the Rosh Hashiva? There are 7 rows of 10 people each, like a Sanhedrin. Each one of these Reishe Kale is in charge of 10 people. He's in charge of a row. In other words, he's the Rebbe of another row. So there's 7 rows, 70 people. Him, together with 9 other people, that's 1 kala. So every one of these 7 people in the front row, they are Reishe Kala, because they're in charge of this row, which is 10 people, sitting in the 70 people in front of the Rosh Hashiva. That's the Sanhedrin. I don't know if they probably acted like the Sanhedrin, says like they did. I don't know if they had a Sanhedrin, they probably did have some form of Sanhedrin, but that was the Sanhedrin in the Masifta. That's what he says. Now, Vasori Shesh, line number 7. Vasori Shesh Lefonov, Mehen, Roshe Kalos, Zain Mehen Roshe Kalos, Vigimel Chaverim, Veloma Nikoshmom Roshe Kalos, Shikol Echonem, Memune, Alasore, Minas and Edrin. Each one is responsible, including himself, 10. Vehem Nekroim Alufim, Vikachoyo Minhogam, Im Nifter Echon Miroshe Kalos. If one of the Roshe Kalos died, Vieshloi Ben Amamalas Mekoimoi, he had a son who was worthy. Then Yoresh Mokim Oviv. The Yoishaboy, Afilo Yikot Meshonim. He was a huge Talmud Chacham. Even if he's young, he took his father's place in that role. וכך מן החברים, כשיבת אחד מהם, אם היה בנוי מלז מקיימוי, יושבוי, ואין אחד מדלג מן החברוי. Line number 11. ואם אין המאמר כמעלה המוקר מהבוי סוף, but if he's not befitting to take over his father's role as a Roshay Kala in the first row, וראי לשב אחת משיבוי דורי, but if he's able to sit in one of the next six rows, one of the other seven rows, יושבוי, he's good. But if he's not worthy, he's not up to learning like the others are, then you can sit the back rows, which are, how many are there? 2,400 people. That 2,400 people in that yeshiva. Now, was that the whole year through? Maybe not. But clearly, during the Kala month, that 2,400 besides the 70, that 2,500 people, just in Surah, Tamina Chamim, coming a month, coming to hear everything that they sat and learned full time. That's what he said, sat and learned full time. At least they worked also. Sorry, they worked. But they went back to their homes to work, and they knew the Masechta cold when they came back in after 5 months, because they got the herd, and it was discussed, and it was learning. All that, they were part of the 2,400 people. Now, then he says, Shev Shivim Sanhedrin, seven rows. The first row sits, like we said, and then another 10, and another 10, they all face the Rosh Hashiva. Now it says, past the seven rows, it didn't make a difference where you sat. But in the first seven rows, you have to be Roy. If you're the Rosh Hekalo, you're good. If not, you sat the second, the third, the fourth, everybody had their place, everybody had the hierarchy. Past the first seven rows, then everybody, all 2,400 people, sat where they want. Didn't make a difference where you sat, you were just a regular Talmud. But once you see this, you see, it's not so easy just to become a Reish Mezifta. Meaning, probably you went up back row, you know, you become a backbencher, and then you move up, and you move up, you get closer. So by the time they appoint you as a Reish Mezifta, as the Goyin, the one in charge, it took time. You weren't just, you know, until they appointed you, you're already an old person to begin with, and therefore they had only had so many of them in those 450 years. Interesting, if you look in the Gemara, put something similar to that in number 5b. Rabba Banachmeni, Agav Shmoda Noch Nafshei. The Gemara says about Rabba Banachmeni that he died because he was running away from the law. What happened? Ochlu Bekutze Bemalko. The rulers were after him. Amo, they said, Ikechad Gavre Beyudoi. There's one Jewish man, the Kamavatel Treser Alfei Gavre Misrol. There's one man, his name is Rabbi Banachmeni, that he gets rid of 12,000 Jews 1 month in the winter and 1 month in the summer. In other words, that we're looking to collect our taxes from these Jews, and because of one man, 12,000 Jews are gone. They're not home. We can't collect the taxes from him. That's what Rashi explains. So therefore, they had a bounty on the head of Rabbi Banachmeni, because of him, 12,000 Jews were AWOL when the government came to collect their taxes. What is this 1 month in the winter, 1 month in the summer, that they AWOL? 12,000 Jews. So it's not such a chiddush that in Rav Nosson Abadli's time, 2,400 Talmidim were there, sitting in Beis Medrash. Big deal, it's not a big deal. They all came. I'm not sure, by the way, the 2,400 is Talmidim the whole year, or just during the Kala. It seems to be only during the Kala. But these numbers are not inflated. This is what Rav Nosson Abadli says. That's the way it was. They came, 2,500 people came to this monthly Kala, or this year, twice a year, to the Kala to come to discuss the Masechta. So that's one thing, that's the Reshe Kala. The Reshe, let's just see, the Kumpurkan, the Reshe Galvoso, we're going to do in 2 weeks from now, which is the Resh Galusa, that's the Exilarch, Reshe Galvoso. The Reshe Misivoso, that's obviously the Reish Mesifter, which is the Goyin, which is the one in charge. Well, the Dayone Devava are the Dayone Devava. What are Dayone Devava? What does that mean, Dayone Devava? So the truth is, the Chuvus HaGoyinim says, which is Rav Hai Goyin, I think Rav Shri Goyin says, Ushaltim Shum Dine Mamnes, how many people need the number 6a for Dine Mamnes for Din Torah? Says the Chuvus HaGoyinim, Rav Shri Goyin says, Hilchasa, Dine Mamnes B'Shleisha, you need 3 Dayonim, you can have a yochid mumcha, an expert, that you don't need 3, 1 is enough, either reish mesifta, either the reish mesifta, the goyin himself, or dayone de bava.
That's how it used to be.
Yeah. What is a Dayane de Bava?
What was the gate?
I know. So what does it mean, gate?
They always go to the gate.
So nobody knows. Dayane de Bava is a Gaonic term. There's no way in the Gemara says Dayane de Bava. It's a new term. We find in Yukumporkin, Dayane de Bava. What is Dayane de Bava? Nobody knows what it means. So some want to say that Dayane de means that since every Dayan had to be appointed by the exilarch, so once you're appointed, you got to sit at the gates of the city. Like you want to say. Dayana means the Dayan who gets to sit at the gates of the city. That's like an official title by the government, by the exilarch, Dayana de Bava. So number 6b, he says, hard to say that. Why? Because that makes sense, Mati, in the time of Boaz and Ruth. Then they sat at the gates of the city. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash already, they didn't sit at no gates of the city. They sat in Lishkas HaGazis. In the Sanhedrin, they sat in the gates of the city. In the time of Bavel, they sat in the gates of the city. They sat in the Beis Medrash. So what's Dayane de Bava? Doesn't like that shot. Then he says that Sefer Dar Dar Vadarshov, which is not a religious person, but I guess he's quoted because I mean, we usually don't like quoting, you know, whatever. But they all seem to follow him, that Dayane de Bava was a singular person. You had the Av Beis Din, and the Dayane de Bava was the second in command. Dayane de Bava, why is it called Bava? Nobody knows. But Dayane de Bava was the second in command. You had the Reish Masifta, the Goyin, and the Dayane de Bava, the second one. I know. Certainly. What's the language Bava? Nobody knows what that means. So he says that can't be either pshat. He says why? Wait. He says because Rav Shira Goyin talks about certain people he calls Dayane de Bava, and other people he calls Av Beis Din. So he says it can't be the same thing. Meaning, we know in the time of the Zugais, right? They had the Nasi, and we had the Av Beis Din. The time we had, right? You had the Nasi and the Av Beis Din. So they want to say that the Dayane de Bava is the Av Beis Din. But he says not like that by the arrow by number 6b. He says because by the arrow, two lines after the arrow, because he calls Ravona Sama Umar Rav Yosef called Dayane de Bava, and Aaron is called Avezin. So they're not both the same. What does it mean? Then he wants to bring down from the Sefer that Dayane de Bava is Bava means Bava Kama, Bava Mesir, Bava Vasa. So therefore, it's not a Gemara term. Because the Gemara term, they just made the Masechtas. At least they hadn't, at least the Masechtas, which dealt primarily with Chayish Mishmet, was Bava Kama, Bava Mesir, Bava Vasa. So therefore, in the Gaonic period, when they promoted those Masechtas and the Talmud and the Gemaras with it, so therefore, the term Dayane de Bava is a Gaonic term, and it refers to Dayanim of the three Bavas. I find it hard to believe. I don't know why they picked on Bava. What?
That sounds worse.
I don't know what it is. Maybe Bava, I don't know. But clearly, Dayane de Bava seems to be, most say, it's the one person who is the number two in command. There is the Rosh Masifta, the Goyin, and the Dayane de Bava. So that's the Mishbeach that we make every week. We'll do next week. What? I don't know why it's out of order. That I don't know why. That's a good question. Reish Chalei, the regular. Reish Galvasa, Reish Mishivati, and Levavet. It should be like all mixed up. The order, I don't know. I have to look up Shat, I don't know. One more thing which I'm going to do, I guess next week we'll do that. But this is very important. He brings down that during these Kala months, the month of Adar and the month of Elul, so besides discussing what they learned, and the Rosh Hashiva would give shurim about it, and they'd know that Masechta back to front, and whenever there was any shyness which came from all across the world, that's when they discussed it. They brought the Shaila up to the Reish Masechta during that time period. The shyness which came from all over the world, all over the Arab lands, whatever was all one thing, and that's when the Reish Masechta would read the Shaila. Everybody would discuss it. He would ask them, what's your opinion? And then they would say, no, we want to hear what you, we don't want to speak in front of you. He said, no, I insist. And it would be a whole discussion. Maybe it took a few days. And that's when, at the end, the Reish Masifta heard whatever he said. He gave his psak. In other words, they discussed the Shaila and they paskened. And that's when they wrote down the tshuva. And the Reish Galus, the Gain put his name to it. And for some reason it says that whenever a Shaila was asked, it was always came accompanied with money to pay for the Talmidim. So we're going to discuss next week how the Masiftas financially kept abreast. The money came from the exilarch, but money also came from the Shilas, which was sent from an entire world.
Nothing's done in a timely fashion.
What?
There's no Shilas were asked in a timely fashion.
That's, I don't know. That's what it says, that the Shilas were asked during those 2 months. Were there any, I mean, major Shilas, maybe it was an emergent Shilas, was different. But generally, these were Shilas, you know, about how to do it, or psak, or that's the way it was. That generally didn't was. You knew you had a shaila. You sent it in before the kala. And then, and by the way, that makes sense also because that's going to be gathered. So you wanted a message sent back. I'm sure there was somebody there by the kala that was going to that land or going in that area because they came from. It was like a courier service also. So it made sense. What are you going to wait for the postman? Are you going to find somebody to go to that place? Now you know everybody's coming now. They bring the shailas with them, and everybody's going back. You know, brings out. Imagine you had a question in the month of Tishrei. What are you going to do? How are you going to find somebody who's going to go to Bavel? You can do that, I suppose. Much easier. Let's wait for the kala. They're going anyway. We'll send the shaila. We'll send back the shaila. You know, we'll get back the answer within a month after they sent it. So that's what happened also during the kala, which is very important because that's the first time really we find that you had shailas and tshuvas which were being sent from all over the land, and the kala was the time, the yarchei kala was the time when it was optimal to answer those shailas, to discuss with everybody. The goyim put a signature it, and that's where tshuvas ha-goyim came from. Fascinating. We'll see next week the first thing that the goyim were misaken, why one of the first things was about giving a get to your wife, why that was so crucial, and why that was so pivotal, and why that took place in that time period.
Across the caliphate. Is that what they call the Muslim caliphate? But it's true.